Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. The Utah Supreme Court expands to 7 justices after the Senate confirms Stephen Dent and Jay Jorgensen. There's a key reason data center developers are increasingly drawn to Utah, and it lies underground. And the Other Side Academy Network keeps expanding, bolstered by Utah taxpayers and unpaid labor. Some of the stories we're going to talk about in the program today. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins and Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Joining me right now is Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. We've talked about the Supreme Court a bit. But to remind us, the 2 justices were just barely confirmed. That's the news.
Right. Yeah. On Wednesday, the state Senate confirmed Jay Jorgensen and Stephen Dent to fill the 2 vacancies created by the expansion that we've talked about during the last legislative session. And to kind of put it into context, I think the context is important in this case. The Supreme Court has issued a series of rulings over the last couple of years on the redistricting issue, on ballot initiatives, on the state's abortion ban, and they've all gone against the legislature, the Republican legislature. And so they've been pretty frustrated with the Supreme Court, and then last session they voted to expand it from 5 justices to 7, creating these 2 spots that we're talking about that Jay Jorgensen and Stephen Dent are going to be filling. So it's a little bit of a controversial move. The legislature said the expansion was needed to kind of keep pace with the growing state and the growing demands on the court. The critics of that move say that it's trying to change the political makeup, I guess, or ideological makeup of the court. They call it court packing. But these 2 openings were created, and Governor Cox nominated these 2 gentlemen, Jay Jorgensen and Stephen Dent, to do it. Jay is a senior attorney for the LDS Church, has been for the past year. And Stephen Dent is a federal prosecutor down in southern Utah, handling federal cases down in that jurisdiction.
So I don't know how these, nominating processes go in Utah. I'm more familiar with the national because we're glued to it for Supreme Court, where it's kind of like Kabuki theater. The potential justice tries not to answer as much as he or she can. I don't know how it goes on the state level.
Well, they don't answer questions about pending cases or cases that might come before the court. So there were some questions that were asked to Jay Jorgensen in particular about the Proposition 4 case. And he, tiptoed around that. They talk more about in abstractions, I guess, talk about their judicial philosophy. And both of these gentlemen are answered that they're originalists and textualists, which is kind of a judicial philosophy that you look at you limit your decisions to the text of the statute or the Constitution and the original intent of the founders or the writers of that code. It's a conservative judicial philosophy, generally speaking, that takes the approach that the power of the court is limited, and that they should defer when possible to the text and to the intent of the framers of the statute or the Constitution that they're looking at.
The governor will now need to appoint 2 more, right?
Correct. Yeah. So this is an ongoing process, but we've also, in addition to the 2 seats that were added to the court, there are Justice Diana Hagan resigned when the Republican leadership launched an investigation into allegations that she had an inappropriate or an improper relationship with an attorney with a case before the court. So she resigned, and then Chief Justice Matthew Durant, who's been having some health issues recently, announced he's retiring in August. So that created those 2 additional seats. So that'll be 4 seats that the governor will, and the Senate will be filling out of the seven, and just I guess going back a ways, in November there was a fifth seat that Justice John Nielsen filled. So that's a pretty radical overhaul of the court. I mean, it's not something we've ever seen, obviously, with only five seats previously. We haven't seen all five of them filled in less than a year. So it's going to look very different. The makeup of the court is going to be very different than it was just, one year prior.
I should note that some Democrats and conservative commentator Glenn Beck called this court packing, decried this expansion of the court.
Yeah, and Senator Nate Bluin, who's running in the first congressional district seat, on during his comments on the during the confirmation vote on Wednesday, said that, they're changing the rules in the middle of they're changing referees because they don't like the score. He accused them of trying to tilt the balance of the court and make it more favorable to the legislature. And so there's been some real concern about the and it's not just, Democrats per se. It's like you mentioned Glenn Beck, obviously. I had an interview with Christine Durham recently, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who is concerned that when all is said and done, that the court will cease to be an independent check on the power of the legislature, because it will be so there because they've put so many justices on it who are going to be favorably inclined to rule in favor of the legislature. So it's it remains to be seen what the impact's going to be, but that's the concern that's being expressed by some observers.
Governor Cox rebutted that. I think his argument was, well, it was Republicans appointing these before, and it'd be Republicans now, so how can you call it court packing?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, and he says they're going through the same process. It's the same, the same governor who's picking these justices is who picked the last few. So he thinks that's a nonsensical argument. But you can also see that there's no denying that there's a lot of frustration with the way that the Supreme Court has ruled, in the, frustration, I should say, among the Republican legislature and the governor with the way the Supreme Court has ruled in some of these cases in the recent past.
There is a key difference between before and now. The nominating commission. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by this actually when I looked at it. In 2023, the legislature changed the makeup of the appellate nominating commission, which is doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's this panel of individuals who review applications for, potential Supreme Court appointees, and they forward a series of names to the governor, typically seven names to the governor. And before, for the four vacancies before 2023, before this appellate nominating commission was reformed, 14 were men, 14 were women. After 2023, the 19 that have been sent to the governor for the last three vacancies have all been men. So they haven't sent a single female finalist to the governor's desk. And it also tilted a little bit more to about half were BYU graduates before, half were Utah grads. There were obviously several who were neither. They went to school out of state. Since the change in the nominating commission, it's overwhelmingly BYU grads. 15 of 19 have been BYU grads. So you can kind of see, while it's not gotten a lot of attention, one of the big change that they made, frankly, was that before it had to be bipartisan. It had to be made up, no more than four of the seven members could be Republicans. And also the State Bar Association got to recommend to the governor some names of attorneys who would serve on it. They took those two requirements out. So now the nominating commission for the last three vacancies have been all Republicans. And that bar representation is not on there. Whether it's intentional or not, we have seen a different outcome.
We're talking with Robert Gerke, politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have about 8 or 9 minutes left. I want to focus most of the rest of that time on the primary election coming up. I guess this is a good reminder, make sure you vote. And so let's go through this. Maybe start with First District, where this looks, I guess, likely that's going to be a Democrat this time around. In the fall, right? So the primary takes on added importance.
Correct. Yeah, this is the first congressional district is the new seat that was created during the redistricting litigation. It's centralized in Salt Lake County. It's and it leans Democratic. So the Democratic primary, obviously no guarantees, but the winner of the Democratic primary is the favorite to win in November. Right now, we've got Ben McAdams, Nate Bluen, Liban Muhammad, and Michael Farrell, who are the four candidates who are running for that Democratic nomination. Ben is the one who has raised the most money. The only public polling we have is polls that were done by Bluen's campaign, but it does show that Ben is leading. It's kind of turned into this battle between, the progressive sort of liberal-leaning candidates, Bluen, Muhammad, and Farrell, who say that, because this is a Democratic district, they should elect a progressive liberal Democrat, and that Ben is, during his time when he did serve in the U.S. House previously, had a voting record that was not adequately progressive. So they're kind of criticizing him for being too moderate. But as I mentioned, the polling at this point indicates that he is likely ahead, and we'll find out on Tuesday how that goes.
Let's take a look at the other two primaries. So what is now the second congressional district, I think it used to be the first. Take me a while to get used to these. We have Blake Moore against Carrie-Anne Lisenby in the Republican primary.
Right. Carrie-Anne is a former state House member. Blake Moore is the current congressman representing Northern Utah. A lot of the criticism of Blake is that he previously to serving in Congress was a proponent of the Better Boundaries Initiative. And so they are, sort of faulting him for being responsible for Democrats gaining a seat in the state. And so, criticizing him for that, he doesn't live in the district. He lives in Salt Lake County, and they think that should be a strike against him. So she's gone after him pretty hard on those two issues mainly, and as well as some others, accusing him of insider trading recently, which drew a pretty strong reaction from Blake Moore's supporters. Beating an incumbent is hard. Talking to politicos in the area, they think Blake is going to be all right. He recently got the endorsement of President Donald Trump. But kind of like you were touching on earlier, this district is a heavily Republican district. So the winner of the primary on Tuesday is likely going to win the general election in November.
Let's briefly take a look at the congressional district number three, Celeste Malloy, going against Phil Lyman.
Yeah, Phil is a former state House member. As you remember, he ran for governor against Spencer Cox, a very conservative guy. Celeste is narrowly won her election 2 years ago in the primary against Colby Jenkins, just by I think it was less than 300 votes, if I remember. So it's been a hard fought race. Celeste, again, sort of like Blake, beating an incumbent is difficult, and so the conventional wisdom is that she's, a favorite to win. This is also a new district. It's huge. It's all most of southern and eastern Utah, a massive new district. So, but that one is going to, we'll find out Tuesday who wins. But again, like I said, Celeste is the favorite there in most people's eyes.
State Senate race involving the Senate president, Stuart Adams. He's in a tough race against two challengers.
Yeah, there's a handful of state legislative races, actually, that we're keeping a close eye on. Stuart Adams has been in the legislature for 20-plus years and is facing probably his toughest challenge yet. Stephanie Hollis is a former general counsel at Weber State University. But he also has had these some baggage, most notably, I think, and most recently, the data center project that was approved by the MITA authority that he chairs, that is sort of polarized, or it's not even polarized, it's got sort of widespread opposition to it. He tried to walk that back with his demanding concessions on the size of the data center. And so his campaign message now is that, when he listened to voters when there was opposition to it and got those concessions and should be lauded for that. But this one's going to be really close, and it's notable because A, he's probably, if not the one of the most powerful politicians in the state, and I guess B, that he's never really had significant opposition, and this is unusual. There's a third candidate in it. His name is Braden Hess, and so there is some thought that maybe Hess and Hollis could end up splitting the vote, and Adams could win, pull out a victory there. There's a couple other races. Doug Feofia is running against State Senator Dan McKay. Feofia is a House member who is giving McKay a pretty tough race. There's Jordan Tusher, who's being challenged by Scott Stevenson. This one has some echoes of the union referendum, if you remember, the anti-union bill that the legislature passed. Tusher was the sponsor of that. Stevenson is the executive director of the Fraternal Order of Police, which was one of the groups that was supporting the referendum effort to repeal that bill. So there's some of that sort of lingering. Brady Brammer down in Pleasant Grove has a tough race with Kelly Smith. And so it's kind of interesting to see some of these races that, oh, and the other one I should mention is Trevor Lee and Bob Stevenson up in Layton as well. Stevenson's a county commissioner. Trevor Lee is a social conservative who's, kind of become a lightning rod for some criticism for some of his legislation that he supported. So it's interesting to see this many incumbents facing stiff challenges in this primary season, at least. And so we'll watch how those turn out on Tuesday.
So I think the Democratic primary is open, is it? The Republican closed. What if you can, if you're an independent or something, can you switch to Republican to vote?
That's a really good question. So yeah, the Republican primaries are closed, so you have to be a registered Republican. And under a law that was passed recently, you have to have registered as a Republican prior to the election in order to vote. But if you are a registered Republican and you haven't received a ballot, you should have received a ballot by now. But if you haven't, you can go to your county clerk or contact your county clerk and find out a in-person polling location. Democratic primaries are open, so you are able to, while it's too late to request a mail-in ballot, you can go, like I said, contact your county clerk, find your polling location, and vote in person. Whether you're Democrat, independent, or even a Republican can vote in those. And we actually, there's been some discussion about in the past, Democrats have registered as Republicans in order to be able to vote in the Republican primary. There's some talk of Republicans voting in the Democratic primary now. This because, especially in that first congressional district, because that likely will be the one, as you mentioned earlier, that determines the likely winner in November.
All right. Well, a good preview there, and make sure you get your ballot in on those primary races. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Following a break, we'll continue behind the headlines, and we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Here's the headline. There's a key reason the data center developers are increasingly drawn to Utah, and it lies underground. Hope you join us for the next part of Behind the Headlines following this break. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Here is the headline. There's a key reason data center developers are increasingly drawn to Utah, and it lies underground. Peyton, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So I guess we'll spoil the surprise. We're talking about fiber networks. And I guess it should be obvious to me that a data center would need robust fiber.
Yeah, I mean, you say it should be obvious to you, but it's honestly, I don't think obvious to that many people, because it's just these processes that happen underground and in ways that we don't really understand. But yeah, they're kind of the whole way that data centers connect to anything else is through these sort of fiber networks.
Now, we know that these companies have been attracted to Utah. I guess there are some other reasons, but one of the reasons is fiber. So I guess Utah has a robust fiber network?
Yeah, it basically, around the Winter Olympics that we hosted in 2002, the state, you know, wanted to increase sort of connectivity along the highways and interstates here. And so UDOT kind of, you know, took it upon itself to start building out this fiber network that you look at a map and it's basically, I mean, all Utah's major highways and interstates are fiber, like the state's fiber network kind of follow those underground. And so it was meant to just like, you know, increase connectivity on roadways. But like, if you've ever watched a UDOT traffic cam or something, you know, that's what this network was initially set up for. But then, you know, as I get into the story, there became sort of opportunities for public-private partnerships with like rural telecommunication companies and things like that, like to build on top of this network.
Yeah, tell me a bit more about the original purpose. I guess that UDOT wanted to link up all these, their own data points.
Yeah. It's like they, you know, they wanted to have the availability to like, you know, have cameras that they could tune into and like look at live streams for, but also, you know, the traffic signs that you see whenever there's an issue in the roadway or construction or something like that, and just, you know, like general connectivity on the roadway, so that, you know, like the public safety, you know, public safety employees could chat with each other when things are happening. And so that was, you know, the original intention. But yeah, then it started kind of evolving whenever they realized that they could, you know, do these public-private partnerships and partner with telecommunication companies to, you know, get broadband and faster internet to kind of more rural parts of Utah.
Yeah, you have a map included in the story. Fiber does follow the major highways. I guess not every last single highway, but most of the major ones have. Is the fiber running directly under the highway?
I don't know if it's, you know, alongside it or directly under it, but I mean, it appears to me to be directly underneath it, but I don't know the particulars.
So at a certain point, UDOT started taking on private partners to build this out?
Yeah, you know, they partnered with like, you know, kind of your local sort of telecommunication companies like Beehive and Centricom, but then, you know, they also had partnerships with like bigger companies like Google and Verizon and Zayo. And so right now, sort of the split of public versus private in terms of ownership of the fiber network is like 37% of it is UDOT's, and then the rest are shared between 40 plus private companies.
It's interesting. Of course, we know data centers become very controversial. A lot of people in Utah don't want them for various reasons, you know, water, electricity, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So you talked to, or you noted in your story that, is it CentCom? This is a company started by Governor Cox's family.
Oh, Centricom?
Centricom, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they, you know, there was some sort of controversy when this Box Elder County data center project was, you know, first sort of became, you know, the public became aware of it. And because, you know, there was slowly sort of this realization that like, okay, this data center is going to need to plug into some kind of fiber network. Could there be some kind of, you know, collusion with this company that Governor Cox's family started? But they, as far as I can tell, as far as what they're telling me, they don't have anything to do with this project. But you know, they are one of the companies that have like benefited from this fiber network that goes throughout our state.
And then the UDOT spokesperson, I think this is my favorite quote in the whole story, said, "Hey, we build it. And what it's used for is up to other people." I'm paraphrasing. In other words, I guess I can intuit, hey, don't pin data centers on us.
It was kind of hard to get people to even talk to me about this story because they're so nervous about the backlash to data centers. But, you know, as we kind of get into with this story, like because of all the technology companies that exist in Utah and just the number of people here, there seems to be a need for data centers, but it's just the size of the Stratus Project one, I think, is what really, kind of freaked people out.
Now, you talked to some fiber companies. I think even though Utah has a very nice fiber system, it might need to be upgraded for, current use, especially data center use.
Yeah, so it's like the sort of fiber that UDOT put in, was for their sort of specific purposes, and it laid the groundwork such that if a company wanted to come in and run like a hyperscale data center of some kind, they would need to do some kind of upgrades to the existing network. But it's just sort of the difference between starting from scratch and starting from, the existing fiber network that's there. And so it is definitely a benefit to them, but it's not like they can just plug directly into the existing network. Like they'll have to do sort of their own upgrades.
Now, you note that this has been a boon to some rural areas. For example, Logan Canyon has improved cell service, I guess, because of fiber.
You might know about that one more than I do.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's helped with connectivity there, and then they also gave me the example of getting broadband down to the Navajo Mountain High School, like kind of I think it's on the Utah-Arizona border, right? Like in San Juan County. And so yeah, like this fiber network, a rural telecommunications company in this case, like Emory Telecom, was able to use this existing fiber network and build on it to bring broadband to that high school.
So you made reference to the big proposed, I guess, planned the mega center, a data center in Box Elder County. Do we know who's going to be providing fiber for that?
No, I don't know that. There's, when I asked MIDA about this, they told me they couldn't share sort of the who, what, or where details about it. They mentioned that there were three locations, like along that they could plug into, and they mentioned that like the way that the data center would work is that its tenants would contract with major carriers like Zayo or Cogent to transport data to an internet exchange. And so they mentioned Zayo and Cogent, in their response as an example of a major carrier, but I have no idea if those will be the major carriers or who will ultimately be the one that the data center tenants, work with.
You mentioned Zayo. I guess they're a fiber company. They have a bandwidth report. Tell me about that. I guess Salt Lake's included in this. They have some data on Memphis.
Yeah, so their report was basically looking at just demand for this sort of connectivity that their company provides. And the report was saying that they've just seen sort of incredible year-over-year growth in demand for this sort of connectivity between like as these big data centers are being put in. And it noted that Salt Lake City and Memphis in particular had seen a lot of growth in demand for that sort of infrastructure. And they told me that the reason for that was, well, they didn't tell me this report said, but it said the reasons for this is these cities offer affordable and available space and power, catalyzing investment. So basically, there's land here, and there's, in the areas where there's land, they're rural, and so there's not a lot of demand for the energy out there. And so they're able to, I guess, use more of it or build more of it or, do whatever they need to do with power. But for those reasons, Salt Lake City and Memphis are standing out to data center developers.
You talked to another company, Flexential. I didn't know any of these companies existed. It's not my world, I guess. That's why we read the Tribune and you're reporting. So Flexential, they own data centers, and the company was telling you some of the kind of the pros and cons,
Yeah.
and difficulties that they face.
Yeah, and it was interesting talking to them because, like I said, I kind of struggled to find anybody that would talk to me because it seemed like so many people were, just kind of nervous to talk about this issue. But Flexential, they provided their CEO, and they were talking to me about, sort of this other side of data centers. Like there are these large ones that are being put in, to power sort of AI infrastructure and things like that, but the other data centers that exist and that have existed for decades are sort of the ones that Flexential use, which are your healthcare companies, your banks and stuff like that. Like it used to be that these individual companies would have, rooms in their businesses, like server rooms or whatever, that they would host all their own data. As we've been kind of going more digital, there's just and kind of changing the computer processes that get things done, like way more data analytics and things like that. They have sort of outsourced that server room or whatever you want to call it into these like data centers. And so Flexential has four in Salt Lake City right now, and they were telling me that they're looking to build a fifth because there's just that much demand here. Like he had a really good quote, I thought, where he said, "You can see the growth in downtown. There's new logos on the buildings. Those companies need to have their infrastructure supported." So he was, there's all sorts of people wanting to be here and to host their data here and serve clientele here. But he's saying there's like a waiting list in order to do that because there's so much demand on power and things like that. So it was really enlightening conversation.
Interesting. He said, these data centers, if you want to get off the grid, you could go renewable, but you'd still need a lot of land because then you'd need a lot of batteries.
Yeah, like he was saying that you would need, just as much, if not more, land to host a facility that could hold all those batteries if you decided to go renewable. And it gave me a bit of a hint as to why, the Stratos project in Box Elder County, they had been eyeing that Ruby natural gas pipeline, and he was saying like, yeah, that's sort of the playbook right now. It's like, go for natural gas or go for renewables because like the grid is just there's a bit of a waiting list to do these large load studies for power and stuff, and so they're looking for alternatives.
Peyton Harkins telling us about this aspect of data centers, in this case, fiber networks and some other considerations. Just want to take a couple minutes here, talk about this one. This, I think, was last week. In Salt Lake City, you can soon get your groceries delivered by drone. That's according to Walmart. And there's a illustration here of a drone with a Walmart package. How soon does this start up?
They're hoping to get it started by 2027, but it's not exactly clear when it's going to start because there have been some other cities they've announced this project in that they haven't, or this service in, but they haven't started yet. It's only up in, I want to say, oh, one, two, three, four cities by now, but they're hoping by 2027 it'll be up and running in all the different cities they've announced so far, including Salt Lake.
So I just want to quote this. Alphabet's Wing drones can travel at speeds of up to 60 miles per hour, deliver groceries, medications, electronics, other items to customers in as little as 30 minutes using a tether to gently lower packages directly to a customer's yard or driveway. That sounds pretty cool. I imagine there's a weight limit. You can't have your barbells delivered.
Yeah, the packages are limited to about 2 pounds right now.
I guess the limitation has been FAA rules.
Yeah, there was and it still exists a regulation that puts limits on if an operator is flying a drone, if they if they can see it or not. And so they're like if they if you're standing out there and you can see your drone, and they liked to sort of regulate it to that. And so now the FAA has proposed a rule that would make it easier for companies to fly drones outside of a drone operator's line of sight so it could go further distances. And so now that the FAA seems to be kind of loosing these restrictions, companies that had been kind of promising this sort of service for a while are now starting to see the ability to kind of scale up or grow the services now that these regulations seem like they might be going away.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. So we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up following a break, we'll be talking about this story. The Other Side Academy network keeps expanding, bolstered by Utah taxpayers and unpaid labor. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Hope you'll stay with us following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we bring in now Salt Lake Tribune Westside Communities reporter Jose Davila IV. Jose, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, very interesting story you did with Jessica Schreifels. Here's the headline: The Other Side Academy Network keeps expanding, bolstered by Utah taxpayers and unpaid labor. I've heard the Other Side Academy, I think, mostly for me, based on their latest project, or one of their latest projects, where they branched into housing, the tiny housing, et cetera. So, the Other Side Academy, what is this?
The Other Side Academy, it's actually been around for over a decade now here in Utah. It is a program, a recovery program is probably the best thing to call it, for people who have struggled with addictions or have been in and out of jail a lot, maybe even people who have struggled with homelessness a little bit. And they get about half their students, these people who take the program, about half come from the criminal justice system, and then about half show up and basically are interviewed to join the academy. It's not like, a usual or a traditional rehab program. There are no doctors, there are no therapists. It is all peer-led, as in even the leaders of the program have either graduated from similar programs elsewhere or have gone through the Other Side Academy themselves. And the whole idea is that you stay for 2.5 years and basically learn how to live in the real world again. Many of these people, like I said, have been struggling with substance abuse or homelessness or been in and out of jail. So the idea is that this program helps them get back on their feet, get back, learning good habits. And part of it is that they work while they're students as well. And the other side leaders argue that helps them readjust to the real world once they graduate.
What's the success rate? Do we have any statistics?
Sure. So I think the most important place to start is that only about 40% of people graduate the program. Lots of people drop out. It is very much not for everybody, and that is something that leaders will tell you as well. And then once we get around to graduation, there's been about 204-ish people as of the end of last year who have graduated from the Other Side Academy. Again, this is just the academy, not the village. And then after they graduate, there's about a 23% recidivism rate. That's basically 23% of grads are rearrested after completing the program. Overall, about 81% of the graduates are employed, and about 75% of them are sober. Being sober is obviously a part of this program. It does seem to work for a lot of people who go through it. Like I said, it can be hard for folks to finish it out.
So, interesting, in this program, you don't have professional counselors, et cetera. It's peer-led and peer, I guess, run. And there's feedback, I guess. Sometimes, I don't know, confrontational.
Correct. I mean, the model is known as a therapeutic community. And the whole point is that there's not doctors and there's not therapists. That it's really all about the people in the program holding each other accountable. That's a word they like to use a lot. Basically, if you make a mistake, if you are breaking a rule, whatever the case may be, then there's going to be people are going to be honest with you, hold you to a high standard, and then you might have to do some sort of work. There is some level of discipline that's a part of the program. Now, that honesty, that accountability, mainly comes in two forms. One is what participation forms called games. And that's similar language to other therapeutic communities. One is Delancey Street in San Francisco, as well, or in California, I should say. And the Delancey Street is based off of this early, early therapeutic community called Sinanon, which more or less later down the line devolved, unfortunately, into a cult. And this game is where participants and students, fellow students, give each other constructive feedback, and there can be yelling, it can be emotional. That is a core part of the model. The participation forms also, these are forms that we grammaed forward, put in a grammar request for. These are state records. There are also these things known as haircuts, where staff who are peers, staff who have graduated the program, will issue intense feedback to students if and when there is something to correct. And so it is. Peer-led sessions are something that other treatment places do as well, but not quite in the same way that the Other Side Academy does.
It was interesting. I guess if you want to join, you come and sit on a bench in the entryway. Is that how you? And then somebody comes and interviews you.
Yeah, you can also. So that's the main way. If you are more or less walking free, right? You can just come in and sit on this bench, and you'll be interviewed by staff, and they'll basically decide whether or not you're ready, whether or not you're ready to take accountability for anything that may have happened in the past, and really commit to change. Now there are, like I said, about half of the people come from the criminal justice system. So, for example, if you are incarcerated, you can write a letter to the Other Side Academy and ask for an interview, and then they may come to the jail to interview you.
Are there restrictions? Can anybody join?
There are restrictions. So, because they don't have doctors or therapists, you can't really take psychological medication. So if you are on a psychological med, you either will have to give that up or you won't be allowed to join. They also don't accept sex offenders or arsonists or people with dual diagnoses. And then you have to be in good health, because there is this work aspect of the program where you work in one of the affiliated Other Side businesses. They have a moving company. They have a construction company. They have a thrift boutique. You have to be in good health in order to kind of work those jobs. So there are some restrictions. Not everybody is able to join this, even if they really want to.
Now, if you join up, we've talked about some of the ins and outs, but you'll be living rent-free, I guess, in the Other Side housing. On the other side, you're expected to work at one of these businesses, but you will not be paid. And some folks have a little heartburn about that.
Correct. Yeah. You won't be paid, but yes, you do live for free, both room and board. Food. Food obviously is prepared and served to you. So those things are great. You can get connected to healthcare. And as well as for those people that are really making their way closer to graduation, there's a savings match program for people who are working at the really end of this 2.5 year period. You work out at a different company. You don't work at one of the Other Side businesses, but all those money that you're making there, you have to save. And so then the Other Side Academy does have a savings match program for you, as well as some financial literacy courses. You can do a GED course. So there are some real benefits to this outside of the program and the work. The work, however, there are some concerns. I talked to one labor lawyer who thought that there may be a claim that a participant in this program could make that these participants are employees, therefore should get paid for their work, and that they're not volunteering their time to the Other Side Academy and its affiliated businesses. The Other Side leaders pushed back on that. They said that that lawyer was incorrect and pointed to a 2020 U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals case in New York where a man kind of in a similar nonprofit had sued over this wage structure and was denied. The nonprofit prevailed mostly because the court said that the man was getting housing, food, help with his with whatever was going on with him.
You quote at least one prosecutor in the story that thinks this is very effective. What does the judicial system think of programs like this?
Well, so it does depend, you know, prosecutor to prosecutor. But Christine Scott, who we talked to for this story, she is a prosecutor in Utah County. She kind of helped the first person who was really interested in joining something like this, who was in a jail in Utah, that she helped get him to Delancey Street in California. She helped with this idea and helped get this first person on their way. She really likes it. She thinks it's valuable. She knows it's tough love is kind of what she calls it. But she does think it really helps a lot of people. If somebody is in the criminal justice system and is incarcerated, whether it be pretrial or post-trial, and they write this letter, if the Other Side Academy believes that this person is a good fit, they will go, the academy will go and basically argue in front of a judge to say that they should take this person and that they don't need to go to jail or whatever the case may be.
Utah leaders, including those in the legislature, have generally been quite supportive of the Other Side, including carving out a carve-out for government oversight regulation.
Yeah. So in 2018, Republican House Rep Paul Ray ran a bill that basically created a whole new oversight structure for programs like the Other Side Academy. Other Side Academy leaders were really struggling with state regulation. There was a lot of friction there. For example, state regulators told them that, you know, everybody who was a staff member would have to go through a criminal background check. And obviously, that flew in the face of everything that the Other Side Academy thought was good about its model, that these people had criminal records and then could relate to the people that were coming through the program. So that's just one example. But they moved under this bill, which legislators passed with near unanimous support, moved oversight of this program from the Department of Health and Human Services to the Utah Division of Consumer Protection, which is a little bit more of a hands-off body within the Department of Commerce. And instead of issuing licenses and having, more of a power to shut down a program if it was breaking the law, the Division of Consumer Protection does do inspections, but basically once a year. And they don't have as much power, the Division of Consumer Protection, to shut down a program swiftly if there are issues. So that's one way that legislators have been really supportive of this org. I will say that they have also funneled about $17 million, a little less than that. Some of that money is from local leaders, but about $17 million total of taxpayer funds have gone to the Other Side Foundation and its efforts on homelessness at the Other Side Village, this tiny home village you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, a couple minutes left here. Tell me about that, because you note earlier in the story, the Other Side Foundation was quite proud of their policy of not accepting government money. They made an exception for that with their efforts on homelessness.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a good way to think about this. The Other Side Foundation is the big umbrella. The Other Side Academy is sort of one third. Let me say this. The Salt Lake Other Side Academy is one third of the social programs they offer. There's also an Other Side Academy in Denver that the foundation runs, as well as the Other Side Village. Now, the Other Side Village serves a slightly different population. It is for people that have been homeless for a long time. You can have physical health challenges. You can have mental health challenges and join with that program. The model, in terms of being sober and providing feedback to your peers, is the same. It's very similar, but it's tailored towards people who have been homeless for a long time. And you go through a prep school program, and then you, once you graduate that program, you get a house at the Village. The reason that the Village has taken government funds is basically because it's a big capital expenditure. It has cost a lot of money and will cost a lot of money to build this Village all the way out. And as Grenny told us, he felt that the Other Side Foundation owed it to its donors to buttress their funds with any funds they could get that wouldn't, you know, infringe upon the operations of the Village. And so in the end, this money has been capital funding. It has helped the Village build out, but it's not for actually running any of the services provided. It is just the build out funds to pay for the homes, to pay for the landscaping, to pay for the site work at that West Side tiny home Village.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
I just would love people to know that this organization is growing. They're planning to open more businesses. So, you know, you might see them around town. I hope that folks take away a little bit more of an understanding of what they do, how they work, and all that sort of thing.
Jose Dávila IV, West Side Communities reporter for Salt Lake Tribune, has been with us in this segment of the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Our thanks to my guests today, politics reporter Robert Gerke, reporter Peyton Harkins, and of course we just talked to West Side Communities reporter Jose Dávila IV. Hope you'll be with me again next time.